You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her do.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. I hope you're having a great weekend. Tonight's scheduled guest, nutritionist Ann Fisher Silva, has come down with a really bad virus, so she'll be joining us when she's fully recovered, and Mouthful says we hope that's really soon. Instead, tonight we have some special programming. First, we'll hear a special NEA presentation about the book Bless Me Ultima by Rudolfo Anaya, this year's Big Read Sonoma County. Following the Big Read, we have a special radio series, Hungry, the Literary Julia Child, with Julia's take on an excerpt of Cannery Row, when hobos poach a chicken in a 5-gallon coffee can, completely unaware, of course, that they are making the classic poulet au pot, the favorite dish of King Henry IV. But first, Bless Me Ultima, here on Mouthful.
Now, the Big Read.
Ultima came to stay with us the summer I was almost 7. When she came, the beauty of the Llano unfolded before my eyes, and the gurgling waters of the river sang to the hum of the turning earth. The magical time of childhood stood still, and the pulse of the living earth pressed its mystery into my living blood. She took my hand, and the silent magic power she possessed made beauty from the raw sun-baked Llano, the green river valley, and the blue bowl which was the white sun's home. My bare feet felt the throbbing earth, and my body trembled with excitement. Time stood still, and it shared with me all that had been and all that was to come.
That's Cheech Marin reading from Rudolfo Anaya's book, Bless Me Ultima. Welcome to The Big Read. The Big Read is a program created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. I'm Josephine Reed. The largest reading program in history, The Big Read is designed to unite communities through great literature and encourages each American to discover the transformative joys of literature. Here's your host, poet, and former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, Dana Gioia.
Today we'll explore Rudolfo Anaya's luminous coming-of-age novel, Bless Me Ultima.
The story's about a woman who's a healer, a traditional healer in New Mexico. It's a story about culture, it's a story about tradition, it's a story about a woman who represents all the essences of the Hispanic culture of New Mexico.
While it's a story that is very much rooted in place and Antonio's story and all the folk tales of Mexican heritage and of New Mexico, it's also a story that any reader can relate to because of this idea of these different forces in your life that you're struggling with to find out what your true identity is.
I think what Rudy Anaya really told his audience was what Spanish-American culture is about, or was about, and still is for that matter, in this part of the world when he was growing up. He does a beautiful job of it, I think.
Vino como consecuencia una cruel persecución y no hubo libre conciencia ya ni en la Constitución.
Rudolfo Anaya's 1972 novel, Bless Me, Ultima, is set during World War II in the fictional town of Las Pastoras, New Mexico. Santa Fe artist Charles Carrillo.
The setting is a rural Hispanic village in eastern New Mexico, and the Llano, or the Llano Estacado, is the area in eastern New Mexico, which is full of stepped country. We in New Mexico know of northern New Mexico, which is mountainous, and then we know of the Llano part of New Mexico, which is the prairie, the open flatlands.
The Llano was beautiful in the early morning, beautiful before the summer sun of August burned it dry. The mesquite bushes were green, and even the dagger yucca was stately as it pushed up the green stem that blossomed with white bell flowers. Jackrabbits bolted from shady thickets at the approach of the truck and bounded away into the rolling hills spotted with dark juniper trees. The sun grew very white and warm in the clear azure sky.
If you get a map of New Mexico and go to the eastern part, to a little town named Santa Rosa, I was fortunate to grow up there. That's my hometown and probably the best childhood I could have had.
Author of Bless Me, Ultima, Rudolfo Anaya.
I spent summers playing along the river. The neighbor kids, we used to play football, baseball. We lived outside of town, so I had to cross the river and mix it up with the town kids. I could grow up wild in the summer and playing along the river and come fall and trudge into school and get civilized.
Tony Hillerman lives in New Mexico and sets many of his mystery novels there. But his childhood was spent in a tiny town in Oklahoma that reminded him of Las Pastoras, the setting of Bless Me, Ultima.
You knew everybody and everybody knew you. No secrets. Always claimed it had 50 people. My elder sister, who's now 85, says, Tony, you always exaggerated. It had 40. And then she named all 40 to me. Anyway, I could understand his boyhood very well. He made a beautiful picture of it.
Poet Diane Teal teaches literature at the University of New Mexico.
The young boy, Antonio, is about 7 years old, and Ultima, who is a curandera, comes to live with the family, and she has had a very important impact in his life. He knows that she was present at his birth and that she holds somehow the secret to what his future will be. So the story kind of chronicles his getting older year by year and telling the tales of this small town that he's living in, which is kind of midway between where his father grew up and his mother grew up in New Mexico.
Bless Me, Ultima is autobiographical in the sense that I use my hometown, the Pecos River, Highway 66, the church, the school, the little villages and ranches around the town.
Rudolfo Anaya.
I have three older brothers. During World War II, they went off. Very young, 17, 18, they volunteered, all three of them. This becomes kind of a theme in Bless Me Ultima. The three brothers who are away at war come back to the small town and look around and there's nothing here for us, and they move on.
The father has a kind of wish for himself, I think. And he's always had this dream to go to California and start a new life. And he has a kind of wandering soul. And that's the way the Mares family is always described, as wanderers. Antonio has three older brothers who were part of this father's dream, but the father feels that he has lost them in some way.
Writer Ishmael Reed.
The three brothers return from war. And they're restless, not only because they have the blood of the conquistador, as they say, and because they have this sense of wandering in their genes, but they just are not going to follow the old ways. they insult their parents. They talk out of turn. Eventually, brothers go to Las Vegas and wander around the country, and there's a hint that they get into trouble. So the war changes things.
Antonio is the youngest of six children. While the absence of his older brothers becomes an increasing source of tension at home, Antonio's parents argue over the future of their seven-year-old son. Diane Teal.
In some ways, the father sees this son as his last resort. So that throughout the book, there's that pressure from the father who's always saying, oh, but you are Amadis, you are Amadis.
Marguerite Fernandez Olmos wrote a critical study of Rodolfo Anaya.
His mother and father came from two very different backgrounds. His father was a cowboy. His father was a vaquero. His mother's family were farmers. They were people who settled the land, and his family had deep roots in that area of New Mexico.
Rodolfo Anaya.
Antonio, the main character of the book, also has to deal with the conflict that the parents seem to impose on him. The mother says, our way of life is changing. You've got to have an education. And one way to get that education would be to become a priest. And the father says, I want him to be like me, a cowboy, a vaquero. And that way of life also was dying in the 40s and 50s.
Throughout the book, there is that tug from both sides.
Diane Teal.
It's interesting that it occurred from the very moment of his birth that the father wanted to claim him and the mother wanted to claim him. And then only Ultima really knew what his life would hold for him.
Ultima asked, why are they so strange and quiet, and why are my father's people so loud and wild? She answered, it is the blood of the Lunas to be quiet, for only a quiet man can learn the secrets of the earth that are necessary for planting. They are quiet, like the moon, and it is the blood of the Mares to be wild, like the ocean from which they take their name, and the spaces of the Llano that have become their home. I waited, then said, now we have come to live near the river, and yet near the Llano. I love them both, and yet I am of neither. I wonder which life I will choose. Ay, hijito, she chuckled. Do not trouble yourself with those thoughts. You have plenty of time to find yourself. But I am growing, I said. Every day I grow older. True, she replied softly. She understood that as I grew, I would have to choose to be my mother's priest or my father's son.
Rodolfo Anaya.
We call the Rio Grande Corridor here in New Mexico is also a very spiritual corridor. It has the bedrock of the Pueblo Indians, Navajo, Apache. Into that come the Spaniards and the Mexicans with their Catholic religion. Later on, Anglo-America comes in. And so you have a fascinating kind of laboratory, a kind of place where these cultures are mixing, learning from each other, and quite often in conflict.
Charles Carrillo.
It's a fabric. If you think of New Mexican peoples being threads of a fabric, and the fabric is woven of aspects of different cultural elements, but what they did have in common was they all learned to speak a language which was Spanish, and they all became Catholics.
Ishmael Reed.
You got all these different cultures working at one time, but there's change, there's looking forward, but still the old beliefs linger. And I think that's the point of this book, is that no matter how some religion, like what you call the major religions, try to sweep the world or globalize the world with their ideas, the old ways still persist.
Many of those old ways and old stories are woven into Rodolfo Anaya's work.
What came into New Mexico with the Spaniards and the Mexicans was a body of folklore, of what we call cuentos, folk tales. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of folk tales. For all those hundreds of years when there was no TV or radio, people told stories. And those cuentos, those folk tales, were just passed on generation after generation. They contain the basis of our belief system in many ways, our values.
al tiro me presento con paso lento y agitadamente.
The people from Las Pasturas always had stories to tell about the places where they had worked. Sometimes they talked about picking cotton in East Texas and about running whiskey into the cotton fields of dry counties. Sometimes they talked about picking broom corn. And as they talked and laughed, I could see the rows of green broom corn and I could smell the sweet scent it left in their sweaty work clothes. Or they would speak about the potato fields of Colorado and the tragedy that befell them there. They left a son in the dark earth of Colorado, crushed into the tilled earth by a spilled tractor. And then even the grown men cried. But it was all right to cry because it was fitting to grieve the death of a son. But always the talk would return to the stories of the old days in Las Pasturas. Always the talk turned to life on the llano. The first pioneers were sheep herders. Then they imported herds of cattle from Mexico and became vaqueros. They became horsemen, caballeros, men whose daily life was wrapped up in the ritual of horsemanship. They were the first cowboys in a wild and desolate land which they took from the Indians. Then the railroad came, the barbed wire came, the songs, the corridos became sad, and the meeting of the people from Texas with my forefathers were full of blood, murder, and tragedy. The people were uprooted. They looked around one day and found themselves closed in. The freedom of land and sky they had known was gone. These people could not live without freedom, so they packed up and moved west. They became migrants.
You're listening to The Big Read from the National Endowment for the Arts. Today we're discussing Bless Me Ultima by Rodolfo Anaya. The old woman who comes to live with the Mares family in Bless Me Ultima is a curandera.
A curandera is someone that has a gift of healing. They learn from older people that have been doing it forever. In my biological mother's family, there was a curandera. That's probably where I get this.
Maclovia B. Zamora works as an herbalist at the B. Rupi drugstore in Albuquerque.
And we'll go through here. We actually have a 400 or maybe less, but they're all usable. There's quite a few that we bring from home or that we pick and grow. And some of those are like the rose hips that are here. They're almost the size of a little apple. And we have here some oregano. Of course, oregano is wonderful for the lungs and for coughs and anything that has to do with the cold. And the mimosa is something to relax with. Mimosa is a blossom, and it relaxes you, you know, like in the south. So I would like to have a mimosa tea in a tiny little cup. And trementina, of course, is pine salve. And that's
every year, Maclovia hosts a group of curanderas who come up from Mexico to offer their services to the community. The curanderas have a wide range of talents that include massage, herbal remedies, spiritual cleansings, and even chiropractics.
When I was growing up, the curanderas were people who helped when there was a baby to be delivered, or maybe somebody broke an arm and fell off a horse, couldn't get to a doctor. They had herbs from the countryside. They did a lot of praying. Prayer is very important.
I ask God permission in these moments.
Esa persona que tiene tantos problemas en su corazón.
Maclovia Zamora translates this historic recording of Felipa Sanchez, a curandera from Cuernavaca, Mexico. Here, she gives a Catholic blessing before a healing session.
Now, give me the words, adequate words, that I can help them that come for help. Now she takes away all the bad in God's name. Everything is in your name. with harmony and peace, with love, so that this person will get well.
Charles Carrillo.
Última, which means the last one, she's kind of opposite the bruja. The bruja translates as a witch. In order to be a successful curandera, a person needed to know what kind of magic or potions or powers that brujas had so that you could counter them. And the only way you knew that was to be as close to a bruja as you could be, but be on the good side.
Diane Teal.
Ultima has been, throughout the book, performing various kinds of exorcisms, I suppose would be a word for it, dealing with this one individual and his three daughters, Tenorio, who are carrying out evil practices, and the father of the daughters has vowed revenge.
Are you afraid? She asked in turn. She put her bowl aside and stared into my eyes. No, I said. Why? I don't know, I said. I will tell you why, she smiled. It is because good is always stronger than evil. Always remember that, Antonio. The smallest bit of good can stand against all the powers of evil in the world, and it will emerge triumphant. There is no need to fear men like Tenorio. I nodded. And his daughters? They are women who long ago turned away from God, she answered. And so they spend their time reading in the black book and practicing their evil deeds on poor, unsuspecting people. Instead of working, they spend their nights holding their black masses and dancing for the devil in the darkness of the river. But they are amateurs, Antonio. Ultima shook her head slowly. They have no power like the power of a good curandera. In a few days, they will be wishing they had never sold their souls to the devil. The power of the doctors and the power of the church had failed to cure my uncle. Now everyone depended on Ultima's magic. Was it possible that there was more power in Ultima's magic than in the priest?
When I started writing Bless Me Ultima, I was writing Antonio's story. This boy growing up in a small town like my hometown and dealing with things that I did, you know, fishing and school and church and listening to the stories of the people from the community. One night when I was writing late at night, Ultima appeared to me, let me put it that way. She stood at the door and she asked me what I was doing, and I said I was writing a story, and she said that she had to be in the story. And when I asked her her name, she said Ultima, and that's when the novel came alive. Ultima's a guide for Antonio. So she's the one that's going to open his eyes and take him into this spiritual world, this world of nature.
The culture of New Mexico is infused with Catholicism. From the icons in private homes to the public art and literature of the region, there is a constant presence of the images, beliefs, and stories of the Roman Catholic faith. NEA Heritage Fellow Charles Carrillo is a santero, a carver and painter of sacred images.
In New Mexican experience, everything people did was based upon some kind of Catholic belief. There was a saint for everything. I mean, there was a saint for toothaches. There was a saint for, you know, people who had a limp. There was a saint for lost objects. If you lost something, you always were bending St. Anthony's ear someplace. You know, St. Anthony of Padua, it was a saint for everything. And so it structured people's lives. And basically, Ultima, it's kind of the collective memory of every saint that you need something for. She's a saint of the New Mexican experience. She has the answers.
My mother had told me the story of the Mexican man, Diego, who had seen La Virgen de Guadalupe in Mexico. She had appeared to him and spoken to him, and she had given him a sign. She had made the roses grow in a barren, rocky hill, a hill much like ours. And so I dreamed that I, too, would meet the Virgin. I expected to see her around every corner I turned.
While the young Antonio grows in his Catholic faith, he also experiences other spiritual forces that leave him struggling with unanswered questions. Diane Teal.
Simultaneously, there is this other potency in his life, and that's described very beautifully in terms of this golden carp that is a kind of godlike figure in many ways. And trying to find a way to reconcile both that religion of the church and then the religion of the land and the natural world.
I don't know if one could say that this book presents a different alternative religion. Well, perhaps it does.
Marguerite Fernandez Olmos.
He respects all these different religions, but he goes back to those of his ancestors. His ancestors include, of course, the Spaniards and others, but he tends toward his Native American tradition.
Rudolfo Anaya first published Bless Me Ultima with a small press in Berkeley, California, after winning a literary award. The book quickly became associated with the Chicano civil rights movement in the 1960s and 70s. The novel was not only a landmark book for the Latino community in the American Southwest, Bless Me Ultima has also found a committed international audience. Charles Carrillo.
Rudolfo's success was to tell a story that touched the hearts of not only New Mexicans, but that touched the hearts of people all over the world, because I think he was talking about change. It's a universal experience of we have a traditional culture, and how do you still live in that traditional culture, but how do you become an American too? You know, you can live the American dream and you can still hold on to your traditions is basically what he's saying. And I think it was the first novel written by a Hispano that said that.
Tony Hillerman.
It gives people whose forebears are from Germany and Ireland and Cambodia some feeling for the cultural background of the people whose great-great-great-grandfathers came from Spain. And I think that's important in the United States. We need to start understanding each other better.
Marguerite Fernandez Olmos.
When you read Bless Me Ultima, you discover a whole magical world of the Chicano that we were not exposed to before. So this is the kind of work that would help us to understand the people who are growing to be our neighbors more and more.
Ishmael Reed.
It shows the culture at its best and at its worst. You got the witches here, but you also have curandero. You have nobility. You have cowardice. You have people who are responsible, people who are irresponsible. I mean, you get all types. Get inside of the family experience of the characters in this novel, this Chicano family, and some of the tensions there and how they treat things. I mean, there's some things that you can learn here, like the way elderly people are treated and the extended family, how that works in this culture. It's something that people should learn. I mean, also sympathize with how they deal with change and understand why people behave the way they do. This book ranks next to some of the great novels in the American tradition.
Ten compasión de nosotros.
Rudolfo Anaya.
When I found Ultima, or when she found me, I realized that the story was going to be more than a rites of passage novel. It had to go deeper. It had to go into the world of legend and mythology and symbolism, and I had to take that journey, and it wasn't going to be overnight.
I dropped to my knees. Bless me, Ultima. Her hand touched my forehead. And her last words were, I bless you in the name of all that is good and strong and beautiful, Antonio. Always have the strength to live. Love life. And if despair enters your heart, look for me in the evening when the wind is gentle and the owls sing in the hills. I shall be with you.
There's so much beauty in people, the people especially that I knew as a child. The ranchers I would come in and visit with my dad told fantastic stories, and I'd sit there and listen. The town drunk was a hero to me. Sometimes we'd sit around the dinner table, or in the summers, we'd go out and make a little fire near the house and tell stories, and all of that the whole idea of that oral tradition sparks the imagination.
Thanks for joining The Big Read. This program was created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. It was written and produced by Dan Stone. Readings from Bless Me Ultima were by Cheech Marin. Historic Mexican corridos used with permission of Smithsonian Folkways recordings. Religious masses sung by the Choral Society of Washington and used courtesy of Naxos. Original music by Clint Hoover and Pat Donahue. Passages from Bless Me Ultima, copyright 1972, were used with permission of Rodolfo Anaya and Susan Bergholtz Literary Services. Special thanks to Jeff Hart, Adam Campy, Erica Koss, and two ARC contributors, Rodolfo Anaya, Charles Carrillo, Tony Hillerman, Marguerite Olmos, Ishmael Reed, Diane Teal, and Maclovia Zamora. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Dana Gioia.
For more information about The Big Read, go to www.neabigread.org. That's www.neabigread.org.
You're listening to Mouthful on KRCB. This presentation is in conjunction with The Big Read Sonoma County. For more information, check out our Facebook page. In tonight's next segment, we hear an excerpt from Cannery Row, annotated, so to speak, by Julia Child, Chef Carlo Midioni, and cooking teacher Shirley Fong-Torres. Here's Chicken a la Steinbeck. You're listening to Mouthful on KRCB.
Chicken a la Steinbeck is a gift from the Julia Child Foundation.
It's about eating and about some cooking, and most of all about people. It's about much more than food. Cooking is almost always about more than food. Hello, I'm Julia Child. This is from Cannery Row by John Steinbeck.
In Carmel Valley, the artichoke plants stood gray-green, and the willows were lush along the river. They turned left up the valley. Luck blossomed from the first. A dusty Rhode Island red rooster who had wandered too far from his farmyard crossed the road, and Eddie hit him without running too far off the road. The Carmel is a lovely little river. It isn't very long, but in its course, it has everything a river should have. It rises in the mountains and tumbles down a while, runs through shallows, is dammed to make a lake, spills lazily into sycamores, spills into pools where trout live, drops in against banks where crayfish live. A few miles up the valley, the river cuts in under a high cliff from which vines and ferns hang down. At the base of this cliff, there's a pool, green and deep, and on the other side of the pool, there's a sandy little place where it's good to sit and cook your dinner. Mac and the boys came down to this place, happily. It was perfect. It was a place to relax, a place to be happy. On the way out, they had thriven. In addition to the big red chicken, there was a sack of carrots, which had fallen from a vegetable truck, half a dozen onions, which had not. Mac had a bag of coffee in his pocket. In the truck, there was a 5-gallon can with the top cut off. Such things as salt and pepper had been brought. Mac and the boys would have thought anyone who travels without salt, pepper, and coffee very silly indeed. Without effort, confusion, or much thought, 4 round stones were rolled together on the little beach. The rooster, who had challenged the sunrise of this very day, lay dismembered and clean in water in the 5-gallon can with peeled onions about him, while a little fire of dead willow sticks sputtered between the stones. A very little fire. Only fools build big fires. It would take a long time to cook this rooster, for it had taken him a long time to achieve his size and muscularity. But as the water began to boil gently about him, he smelled good from the beginning.
This is the classic poule au pot, or poached chicken. And Mac and the boys really do have the idea with their small twig fire. Poaching means slow cooking in an aromatic broth. This is at the lowest, slowest bubble. It's an ancient and lovely way to cook chicken, where the broth flavors the chicken and the chicken flavors the broth, and you get the best of both. Poaching is, in fact, the only way you can cook a mature bird, since its flesh, while full of flavor, is firm. It wants long cooking over low heat. In other words, as Steinbeck's hobo says, only fools build big fires. And although there are lots of things you can do with a poached chicken, the boys in Cannery Row have the secret advocated by Escoffier himself. Keep it simple. Here's another simple one from Carlo Midioni in San Francisco. He wrote The Food of Southern Italy. If you open the book, you'll see the photograph of this dramatic-looking pollo al mirto and wonder how in the world you do that. And here's a picture. It's a beautiful whole chicken on a lovely plate, and there it looks like leaves of fresh bay leaves that cover the chicken. And then there's a big copper pot full of polenta, and then the polenta itself on a paddle with cheese and tomato sauce. I could eat that right now. It looks wonderful.
These are going to be my carrots. I'm Carlo Midioni. I ran a rather good restaurant of note called Vivande for many years in San Francisco. We had lots and lots and lots of very famous people come through. And we cooked from Joe Montana to the Queen of Spain to Henry Kissinger, Frank Sinatra. I've had every major movie star and stage actor you can name in there. And Julia Child was a very sweet person. One time, Bill Rice, who was then the food editor for the Chicago Tribune, brought Julia and Paul, her husband, in. So I cooked lunch for them and gave them Prosecco, which is that wonderful sparkly wine from up in the north, Veneto. And she wept. And I thought, oh, my goodness. And I said, is everything okay, Miss Child? And she said, oh, yes, yeah, it's just perfect. And she said, you know, this is what Paul got for me when we were in Venice. And she said, and I have such fond memories of it. It was really sweet and very nice. There we have carrots, celery, onion. Here's some garlic. And we almost have the odori ready to go. The odoris are mostly relating to herbs, flavors, odors. Odori is what the Italians call it. So I've got some vegetables cut up here. Now I have to get a chicken. And I'm going to take a nice big plump chicken here. Now I'm going to wash my chicken. I don't ordinarily like to do that because it just adds water and it, like, under the skin and everything, you know. But since I'm going to be poaching this anyhow, then I am going to do it. I have a friend in Italy who washes chickens with soap and water. She just literally takes a scrub brush and, like, fells naphtha soap and scrubs it, and then rinses it many times to get rid of the aroma of the soap.
I think Howard Hughes used to do that.
Oh.
Maybe he's a cousin.
You never know.
This chicken that I'm cooking right now is called pollo al mirto. It means fowl, actually, but in this case it's chicken. with myrtle leaves. And you might say, well, you're going to make it with bay leaves, aren't you? And I'm saying, yes, I am, because I don't have a myrtle bush. But I'm going to get one. However, the taste of myrtle and bay leaf is very similar. To me, it's a sort of a combination of juniper and rosemary put together. It's an herb. You put it in stews, you put it in soups, whatever. And it, when you do that, it leaches out the flavor. And the flavor can be quite strong, so you have to go easy. For a couple of quarts of soup, you wouldn't want to use more than one large bay leaf. If you put things in cold water and let it come up to the heat, cold always draws things. When you want to make a stock, you start with cold water and it draws things out. Usually for a quart of water, you want a teaspoon and a half of salt. So I can always add more later if I want to. I could put a lid on it. That'll help it a little bit. And then that's all there is to it. So this should cook for about an hour, and then we'll check it out. If you can't do this, you can't do anything.
The men slept. Only one stayed awake to replenish the little fire under the cooking chicken. There is no golden afternoon next to the cliff. When the sun went over it about 2 o'clock, a whispering shade came to the beach. The sycamores rustled in the afternoon breeze. Little water snakes slipped down to the rocks and gently entered the water and swam along through the pool, their heads held up like little periscopes, in a tiny wake spreading behind them. A big trout jumped in the pool. The gnats and mosquitoes, which avoid the sun, came out and buzzed over the water. All of the sun bugs, the flies, the dragonflies, the wasps, the hornets, went home. And as the shadow came to the beach, as the first quail began to cajole, Mac and the boys awakened. The smell of the chicken stew was heartbreaking. One picked a bay leaf from the tree by the river and dropped it in.
If Mac and the boys in Cannery Row come back to this same place another time, they might cut off a handful of twigs from that same bay tree and have Carlo Midioni's Pollo al Mirto. For a different infusion, you can do the same poached chicken, but instead of cooling it buried in bay leaves, bury it in branches of rosemary or of thyme. It's especially pretty if some of those nice blue flowers are in bloom. The variations on the same theme go on. If you have some sausages and herbs, you can use this same basic recipe to cook up a favorite dish of the French King Henry IV of Navarre. Before you put the bird in the water, just stuff the cavity with fresh pork, sausages, and herbs. King Henry IV was a warm-hearted king, and when he tasted this poulet au pot, he fervently wished that every subject of his realm might taste it every Sunday. The trick, of course, is simplicity.
I'm checking this chicken. It's looking really good, and I'm trying to make this fire go a little lower. Oh, look at how nice that bird is. And you notice, see, the breast is popping up out of the water, and that's good because it's not going to be as cooked as the other parts, which you want them cooked a little bit more.
So if you have your choice, how do you choose a good bird?
Well, when I go shopping and I need to buy a chicken, I look at them very carefully, and if they're packed in cellophane and they're loaded with water, I tend not to buy them. And almost all that I see nowadays are packed like that, and I don't understand why that's necessary. So I look for ones that are packed in ice, that are exposed, and hopefully they're dry when they're picked out of the ice. And if you just pat them dry, then they're perfectly fine to cook. And then I look for ones that have heavy thighs and legs and wings. And when the breast is too big, then I tend not to buy that one. Because the breast meat is white, and everybody thinks it's the best part, but I don't agree. I like the legs, the thighs, and the wings. I think my sense of taste, which I really unashamedly say is quite good, from my mother. She always, I could see her thinking about the flavors. She would taste everything. She would smell everything. And then somehow this judgment would come that, yes, this is good, or you know what, it needs something. And she always knew what that something was. So I was very, very, very pleased that I was often asked to help her prepare food. So that I learned, but it wasn't like reading a book. I have nothing against reading a book. I read plenty of them. But for learning the way I learned, I wouldn't trade it for anything. She had technique. She was very good. As a matter of fact, she used to kill our own chickens, because that's what we served, our own and our own rabbits. And she was quite an expert assassin in one sense. The reason she wanted to do that is that she wanted to select just the right bird or the right rabbit or the right goat. And if it wasn't right, then there was no point in harming the poor thing, you know. So I learned to appreciate life and death, because you know, you have to have both. And one comes before the other, so you should make the most of it while you can. But what I learned from her is that if you don't pick the right ingredient at the beginning, no matter how careful and good you are at preparing the dish, you won't end up with one as good as it could be. And I'm a firm believer in that. You start out with the best, and that doesn't mean the most expensive. My mother was a chef in the kitchen, but you know, in those days, women were simply not called chefs. And actually, if you were a woman and you said you were a chef, you know, the whole world might have blown up. It might have just exploded right in front of everybody, because women just were not chefs. That's all there was to it. They were cooks, and very good ones. And what I'm very proud to say is that my mother, were she alive today, would be in the top ranks of chefs, because I think she has something that a lot of chefs don't have, which is the sense of taste and balance and making things just delicious. And you know, if you're going to eat, why not have it be delicious?
The carrots were in now. Coffee in its own can was simmering on its own rock, far enough from the flame so that it didn't boil too hard. Mac awakened, started up, stretched, staggered to the pool, washed his face with cupped hands, hacked, spat, washed out his mouth, broke wind, tightened his belt, scratched his legs, combed his wet hair with his fingers, drank from the jug, belched, and sat down by the fire. "By God, that smells good," he said.
You know, if the Steinbeck hobos, which are really interesting people, I'd love to meet up with them sometime and cook with them, if they didn't have a pot and water and all that stuff that you need to make poached chicken or boiled chicken, they could have still got a chicken even with the feathers on it. You should eviscerate it, and that's pretty easy to do with a knife. Most people could find a knife somewhere. But if you just could get some mud or make mud, you need a little water and dirt, and make sure that it's quite heavy and is the consistency of, of maybe a bread dough, something really strong, and pack that all over the bird and just make sure that there's no openings anywhere except for one little hole somewhere, maybe toward the top or the bottom, just a hole about a quarter of an inch wide, but all the way through. And then leave that mud to sit on the chicken until it firms up a little bit, then build a fire. And in this case, it could be a good strong fire. And very carefully place the chicken covered in the mud right in the flames, and then just leave it there. And maybe in 20, 30 minutes, get a stick and try to turn it over to the other side and let it cook another 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And then somehow roll it off of the fire. And when it's cool enough that you can deal with it, just pick up a rock and start cracking open the mud. And as you pull the mud off, the feathers will come off the bird, because they'll have stuck to the mud and cooked in there. And you'll probably lose a fair amount of skin, too. But the chicken itself will be wonderful. You don't need salt, pepper, or nothing. It just will be chicken. And you know, the Italians have a dish called pollo alla zingara. Zingara is gypsy chicken. And the whole idea is that, you know, gypsies are on the move, and who knows, they don't have a whole lot of stuff like kitchenware. So probably they would cook the same way. And I make a version of that using clay, because clay is mud.
Simple poached chicken is a staple in all kinds of cuisines. The Chinese, for instance, do wonderful things with chicken. Let's hear what they have to say.
Wai, nei ho. That means hello. How are you doing in Cantonese? I'm Shirley Fong Torres from San Francisco. I'm the owner of Wok Biz Chinatown Tours and Cooking Company. Oftentimes, our guests point to chickens that are hanging in the Chinese delis and ask, what are those? And so it's with great, great love that we talk about chicken, poached chicken, barbecue chicken. It goes on and on. The Chinese have been poaching chicken forever, it seems. And when I grew up in Oakland's Chinatown, my restaurateur father and mother would often serve us that type of chicken. It's so healthy. So let's talk a little bit about it, because there are so many different ways of poaching chicken. To do it Chinese style, we basically cook it for about 20, 30 minutes. The chicken is placed in a pot, is covered with water, and we put in items such as sea salt, ginger, green onions, some dry sherry or Chinese wine, and then we slow cook it. We bring the water to the boil, and then we simmer it, and then the flame is turned off, and the chicken stays in a pot, and the hot liquid actually finishes off the cooking. Now, we do turn the chicken around once so that by the time it comes out, it's cooked nice and evenly. What's interesting about the way the Chinese eat chicken is that once the poached chicken is ready, if it's going to be served as is, it's actually chopped into bite-sized pieces with the bone in. However, in my case, I like to remove all the bones and remove the skin and then use the skin and the carcass to put into a soup pot, and I make juk, which is a Chinese soup. So now you've got this heavenly broth. You just add maybe a cup of rice to it and maybe a little more liquid, and then you just cook the heck out of it until it turns into, it looks like risotto, but it's just really a homemade broth with a little bit of rice. Now let's go back to the chicken. We also can make it soy sauce chicken, which is called poached soy sauce chicken, see you guy. Sometimes people say, what, see you? See you later, guy? See you means soy sauce, and guy means chicken. So see you guy means that we use soy sauce and we use ginger, rock sugar, some garlic, some onions, some wine, and some Chinese five spice. All that is added to a cup of soy sauce, and then the rest of it is water to cover the chicken in the pot. And then you just cook that for 30 minutes, and then the same thing. You put, leave the cover on, turn the chicken over, leave the pot going. It's actually no heat, but then the chicken just keeps on cooking. Then afterwards, you brush a little bit of 100% Chinese sesame oil and let it rest, let the chicken rest, and cut it into serving sizes, and then you top it with green onions and eat, eat, eat. Now, another thing you can do is poach the chicken, and then you remove the skin, remove the bones, and you cut it all up and make something that I love to make, Chinese chicken salad. Sao si gai. How healthy can you be? Everything's been poached. It's so flavorful because all the ingredients in the water have melted into the chicken. And so you take the chicken meat and you hand shred. Sao si. Sao means hand. Si means to shred. So you hand shred the chicken, and then you add it to your salad bowl and add cool ingredients like iceberg lettuce, sesame oil, what else did I put in there? A little bit of onion, and then you just toss all that together with a little vinegar, and you make yourself a nice, nice Chinese chicken salad. When I was in Boston as a guest chef at the Mirabel restaurant, I had the joy of meeting Julia Child. Oh, such memories. We had lunch together in Chinatown, and I remember how gracious she was and how kind she was and how tall she was. I also had the opportunity of having dinner with Julia in her home, but other people were cooking for her that day because she was so busy. She must have had about 30 or 40 people, and so she was just so busy being the gracious hostess that she is. Another idea for the poached chicken. This will be interesting, especially if you have just come home and you're tired and you don't feel like cutting up a chicken and cooking from scratch. Just take some of the chicken meat from the poached chicken and set it aside and heat up your wok. Fire that up with a little bit of oil and then a little ginger, a little garlic, and toss in whatever you see in the fridge from maybe farmer's market. Chinese broccoli, snap peas, water chestnuts, mushrooms, long beans, whatever are your favorite veggies. Stir fry that up and then make a little broth, a little cornstarch and water to make a little bit of a gravy, a little soy sauce. Then you have a light gravy and then you toss in the already cooked poached chicken that's been cut into bite-sized pieces. And then you stir fry that up and you have a beautiful chicken and vegetable stir fry.
All these vegetables are so beautiful, the chicken too. And these foods do such beautiful things for you, building up your immune system, putting roses in your cheeks. In Cannery Row, as the bird has bubbled slowly in its broth, Steinbeck's hobos have been having a nap under the trees. One of the boys is named Hazel because his parents expected a girl. Hazel's kept watch over the fire, and now Mac, Eddie, and Jones are waking up to enjoy the most pleasurable part of their day.
Men all do about the same things when they wake up. Mac's process was Lucy the one all of them followed. And soon they all had come to the fire and complimented Hazel. Hazel stuck his pocket knife into the muscles of the chicken. "He ain't gonna be what you'd call tender," said Hazel. "You'd have to cook him about 2 weeks to get him tender." "How old do you judge he was, Mac?" "Well, I'm 48, and I ain't as tough as he is," said Mac. Eddie said, "How old can a chicken get, do you think? That's if nobody's pushing him around or he don't get sick." "That's something nobody isn't ever going to find out," said Jones.
You know, in Steinbeck's characters who cooked this bird, this chicken, this, I think it was a cock, and said it was tough. Well, you know, a coq au vin, the famous French dish, you have to have a tough old bird. I mean, that's the poor old rooster that has outlived its usefulness. And, you know, people try to make a coq au vin with just a plain old, good old fryer chicken, and it simply doesn't work. I think the texture is wrong. And you also have to use a pretty decent wine, I would think, and some people skimp on that, which is a problem. So maybe if they'd had wine instead of water, they could have had a hobo version of coq au vin, you know?
They ate long and daintily, spearing out pieces of chicken, holding the dripping pieces until they cooled, and then gnawing the muscled meat from the bone. They speared the carrots on pointed willow switches, and finally they passed the can and drank the juice. And around them, the evening crept in as delicately as music. The quail called each other down to the water. The trout jumped in the pool. And the moths came down and fluttered about the pool as the daylight mixed into the darkness. They passed the coffee can about, and they were warm and fed and silent.
And I'm David Litwin, producer, along with Marjorie Leet Ford, of Chicken a la Steinbeck. Michael Belitzos has read from Cannery Row. Chef Carlo Midione has added recipes. So has Shirley Fong Torres. This series, Hungry, is a gift from the Julia Child Foundation.
Thanks for tuning in. Meet me back here next Sunday evening at 7 for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Have a great week.